I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has received some unusual back talk from U.S. troops. Yesterday, the defense secretary was in Kuwait giving a pep talk to soldiers engaged in Operation Iraqi Freedom. He began by urging troops to ignore the negative coverage in the American media.
There are those who see the violence taking place in Iraq, and there is violence, let there be no doubt. And they say we can't prevail. I see that violence and say we must win.
Well, but during question and answer periods that followed, Army Specialist Thomas Wilson spoke up. Now, you might have to listen closely to this sound from CBS News Radio.
Army soldiers have to dig through local landfills for pieces of scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass to unarm our vehicles. And why don't we have those resources readily available to us?
Well, one word you might not have been able to catch: up armor. It means to increase the protection on the vehicle. Rumsfeld reportedly looked startled after that question, and after the applause was over, he asked the soldier to repeat the question.
We're digging pieces of rusted scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass that's already been shot up, dropped, busted, picking the best out of this scrap to put on our vehicles to take into combat.
You go to war with the army you have. Not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time.
After the exchange, Major General Gary Speer, commanding general of troops in Kuwait, says that as far as he knows, all vehicles going into Iraq are equipped at a minimum with locally made side armor, but not bulletproof glass or underbody armor that would protect against explosions coming up through the floor. Well, there is another report today. This one indicates that Donald Rumsfeld's advisors knew 5 months ago about allegations of torture of prisoners in Iraq. Newly released documents show that these beatings and sometimes illegal military interrogations took place even months after the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal was revealed. Barton Gellman is staff writer for The Washington Post. He reported on the story today. Bart, first of all, remind us, you know, we've heard these accusations. What makes this new?
Several things. One is the accusations come from what may be the most credible witnesses yet. You have the man in charge of the Defense Intelligence Agency, a three-star admiral, passing on these reports, and they are directly from witness accounts of his intelligence officers who watched things happen. They watched Special Forces soldiers beating a prisoner in the face to the point that he required hospitalization. They saw prisoners coming in with bruises, burn marks, complaining of kidney pain. And the critical thing about this also is that these allegations or this behavior comes something like 7 months after the first reports to senior Army officials that this same unit was beating prisoners.
Yeah. We know that the ACLU received these documents using the Freedom of Information Act along with 42 other documents, and they show heated battles between FBI and DIA officers objecting to what was going on. Tell us about that.
Well,
by the way, that's Defense Intelligence Agency, I should point out.
That's right. Mm-hmm. This is the Pentagon's intelligence agency. And both FBI special agents and trained DIA interrogators, debriefers, objected many times over a period of many months in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay to the harsh and sometimes violent interrogation methods that they were witnessing. They said they were both ineffective and violations of the Geneva Convention. And what's fascinating to me is a one written report in which an FBI agent tells his superiors that Major General Jeffrey Miller, who was running Guantanamo Bay, said that the FBI has its way of doing business and DOD has their marching orders from the SecDef, that is Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
In fact, they cited Rumsfeld as a source of their authority to use techniques, you write, that the FBI regarded as potentially illegal. Just a few seconds here, Barton. Has the Pentagon responded?
The Pentagon says there have been more than 50,000 detainees and only about 300 allegations of abuse, some of which are unsubstantiated. So it's a rather small number. They say they're doing a transparent investigation, but they did their best to suppress these documents.
As we said, they were retrieved under the Freedom of Information Act. Barton Gellman is a staff writer for The Washington Post. He writes in today's article about the revealed documents. Barton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Consumers are questioning the safety of their prescription drugs after Vioxx, the popular arthritis medication, was pulled from the market in September because it was proven to significantly increase the risk of heart attack. Then last month, an FDA whistleblower questioned the safety of five other drugs. What's going on at the Food and Drug Administration, and what should consumers do to better protect themselves? Dr. Jerry Avorn is author of Powerful Medicines, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs. He also teaches at Harvard Medical School here in Boston. Welcome, Dr. Avorn.
Thanks for having me.
And let's start with Vioxx. This is a drug that was introduced in 1999. Some studies flagged it almost immediately as having possible, you know, potential cardiac risks. So remind us, what were the changes in the FDA that sort of changed that agency and the way it functioned and added, you know, to problems that enabled this drug to stay on the market?
Well, a lot of the problem goes back to 1992 when somebody got the bright idea that the drug companies should actually pay FDA's bills in order to get them to approve drugs quicker.
And this was because the FDA just had no money.
Exactly. And rather than saying this is a problem for the public, let's put more money into FDA from the national budget, which is what many of us would have thought would be sensible. Instead, they went to the drug industry and thought, well, we can save some money for the public treasury by just having the drug companies pay for the approval process required for their drugs.
Well, but there was a quid pro quo.
Yes, and that was that the approvals would be done in a rapid manner, which was understandable, but also that there would be a balancing of the – or an imbalancing, as it turns out, of the FDA's budget such that there would be a substantial quantity of what dwindling resources the FDA did have in its own budget devoted to speeding new drugs, and that ended up taking money away from the piece of the FDA that's responsible for looking at the safety of drugs that are already on the market.
Right, monitoring them. And we should say that at the time, you know, some of the desperation was that a lot of the life-saving drugs that would treat AIDS and other illnesses were just sitting on the shelf because there was no money, again, to process them through any kind of regulatory examination.
That is true. FDA in the 70s and 80s was unacceptably slow, and this was an attempt to fix that problem, but it, in the course of doing so, in this kind of strange privatizing of the budget way, it created new problems at the same time that it was dealing with the old problems.
So now, you know, now there's this imbalance that others have pointed out as well, that there's more of a push to get new drugs out as opposed to monitoring drugs that are already out. And as we understand it, that's when it becomes really critical, because it's when it is, you know, being taken by millions of people as opposed to 1,000 is when you really know how it works.
Right. There were really twin problems with Vioxx. There are some problems that will only become apparent when a drug is taken by millions of people. But there are other problems that can actually be anticipated even before the drug is approved. And that was the case with Vioxx. There were signals in the data about Vioxx from before the drug was marketed. In one study that Merck conducted itself, there was a fivefold increase in the risk of in the rate of heart attacks in people who were given Vioxx in their clinical trials before the drug was put on the market. And that should have been a signal that at least here's something we need to be very careful about scrutinizing.
Drug companies, we now know, spend a lot of money wining and dining physicians. They provide free samples. Are physicians able to resist pressures to prescribe particular drugs? And can you really trust your doctor?
Well, the biggest problem that we doctors face is also this absence of data. It's not just the whining and dining, which I think we can deal with, although I'd rather it weren't there. The big issue is if a patient were to come to me and says, please show me the evidence about the risk of particular side effects with any of these drugs compared to other drugs that we have that I could prescribe instead, I, and this is something I do for a living, cannot turn to any data source to point out to them what the relative risks are so that we can make a reasonable decision together. And again, it comes down to the fact that the drug companies are not doing these studies, the FDA is not requiring these studies once drugs are on the market, and so no one really knows the answer, so that there's a lot of room for promotion and hype and direct-to-consumer ads to dominate the discussion when really that discussion ought to be made on the basis of data, but the data don't exist.
And the consumer ads are another issue. I mean, you have no idea. I mean, they sometimes at the end of them, they'll do that fast talking, you know, may cause side effects, you'll get an extra nose or something. I mean, I don't mean to be facetious, but you have no idea of knowing what those ads are saying. You go to your doctor and your doctor may not know, as you said. So what is a consumer to do?
Well, I think it's always a good idea to have a candid discussion with your doctor when a new drug is prescribed. And if it is also a drug that's not been on the market very long, I think it's fair to ask the doctor, is there a drug that's been around longer that has a better safety record that I might be able To be given instead of this one. And the doctor ought to be willing to engage in that conversation. One of the scariest stories that I looked into in writing Powerful Medicines was a diabetes drug that ended up killing your liver. And we had plenty of diabetes drugs out there that worked just as well, as it turns out, and were not fatal to your liver. And those could have been used. But instead of the data and the actual numbers driving the decision, it was driven by hype and by promotion. And that ended up causing a fair number of deaths.
And, Doctor, what do you think is going to happen in the future? Already we've seen the FDA advisory panel on Intrinza. This is what some are calling the female Viagra. They've recommended not to approve the medication. You know, some women are wondering, wait a minute, is that just, you know, a backlash because of the criticism of the FDA, or is that a good thing that they took a closer look at this? What do you see happening?
Well, I think this could be a wonderful opportunity for the FDA to really get its act together and for the government to take a hard look at how we approve drugs and also how we look at their safety once they're on the market. I'm afraid, however, that we might miss the opportunity because the drug companies are so powerful in Washington and they have such influence over the administration and over Congress that the negative outcome could be that all this will become a tempest in a teapot, and 6 months from now there'll be headlines on something else and we will have lost this opportunity.
Is there a chance that consumers can force a change? Let's say you're taking a prescription painkiller for your bad running knees, but you decide, you know what, with all this bad news, I'm going to switch to an over-the-counter medication for safety. Do you see that they may force a change because of the market?
I think that is likely to happen because the drug companies have perhaps a little less clout in determining the actions of consumers than they do of politicians. A colleague of mine at Harvard Medical School the other day came up to me and said that he was concerned that all these headlines were going to make the public feel less secure about the safety of drugs and make doctors more suspicious about FDA's decisions, and wasn't that a problem? I said, I think you're right. That is going to happen, and I think it's great because I think we doctors need to be a little bit more concerned about whether FDA is doing its job. And I think patients need to be a little bit more willing to say, maybe that ad that I saw on TV is not the only story here. Maybe there is something I ought to be worried about. And consumers can actually play their role by asking hard questions about drugs, both of their doctor and also when they go to buy something over the counter. Do I really need this? Or maybe if I just were eating right and getting more exercise and living cleaner, I wouldn't need to have quite so many medications on board.
Dr. Jerry Avorn is author of Powerful Medicines. He also teaches at Harvard Medical School. We're going to continue our conversation in a minute, and we'll ask, should Americans heed the warnings of FDA whistleblower David Graham, who criticized 5 drugs that are currently on the market? Also, we'll have Dr. Avorn's suggestions for other safer drugs. And later in the program, a conversation with the father of slain journalist Daniel Pearl. He has a new book inspired by his son's last words. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking with Dr. Jerry Avorn about the Food and Drug Administration and the huge gaps in the system for approving drugs. Well, Doctor, during the Senate hearings on the safety of Vioxx, whistleblower Dr. David Graham of the FDA named 5 common prescription drugs he believed require more scrutiny. Now, these range from the weight loss drug Meridia to the acne medication Accutane. Some at the FDA dispute Graham's statements. They say he's just pushing his own agenda. He's a well-known born-again Christian. So, for instance, Accutane can cause birth defects in pregnant women, which in turn might cause abortions, which he is against. And his critics say that shades his view of drugs. Your thoughts, Dr. Avorn?
Actually, Accutane is the one drug that doesn't really belong on that list. The reason for that is that Accutane's risks have been well known for many, many, many years. That is, the risk that it will cause anomalies in an unborn baby or actually precipitate a miscarriage. The problem with Accutane is different in that it's known, and despite the best efforts of doctors and the drug company and the FDA, every year an unacceptably high number of women do get pregnant when they're taking Accutane. The problem really with the other four drugs is different in that it's a question of we don't really know what their adverse effects rate is compared to other drugs that are like them on the marketplace. And the fact that there is so much debate between the manufacturers and the FDA really, I think, makes the most important point here, which is why don't we know so many months after these other drugs have been on the market? Why are we still debating about whether they're safe? Because we don't have the data, because we don't have a system to collect the data.
What were the five other drugs that he named?
Okay, the five were Accutane, which we talked about, Meridia, which you mentioned for weight loss, Crestor for cholesterol, Cerevent for asthma, and Bextra, the other Vioxx-like drug.
Of the drugs that were named, would you recommend people not take them because they were mentioned in a hearing?
Again, Accutane's different in that if you're not pregnant, it's a great drug.
Right.
For several of them, there are good alternatives, and I'm thinking here about Bextra for aches and pains, Crestor for cholesterol, and Cerevent for asthma. We've got drugs in each of those categories that work as well and that don't have this cloud over them about unresolved safety questions. So, for example, as a doc, I would say, or as a family member or as a patient, I would say, if there's a cloud over Bextra, why not go into Celebrex? Or even better, why not go into something cheap like Motrin and take it with something to protect your stomach? If you're on Cerevent for asthma, why not go to some of the older asthma drugs that have been around for decades that probably work just about as well? If you're on Crestor for cholesterol, we've got at least four or five other cholesterol drugs that not only work as well, have got a better proof of their ability to prevent heart attacks than we see with Crestor, which really does not yet have any outcome studies.
And Dr. Ahorn, your thoughts on criticism of Dr. Graham, the whistleblower within the FDA, that he has an agenda because he's a born-again Christian?
I know David Graham, and I think he's a very smart scientist and a very honorable, conscientious guy. It's wonderful that we have people within government of his caliber and of his integrity. The only issue where his own personal values come up is around Accutane, and his religious beliefs have nothing whatever to do with the other four drugs that he mentioned. And I think that's a cheap shot taken to kind of undercut his having identified a glaring problem in the way the FDA works.
Dr. Jerry Ahorn, author of Powerful Medicine, The Benefits, Risks, and Costs of Prescription Drugs, also professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, for a look at the financial impact of the FDA and its decisions, we turn to Business Week reporter Amy Barrett. And Amy, Merck, by some estimates, may lose over $18 billion because of the Vioxx fiasco. Now, company officials say that they've got plenty of money in cash and investments, and they won't have to cut the dividend that they pay out. But do you think that they are healthy enough to withstand this blow?
At this point, the betting is that Merck will survive, although I will tell you there are some people who are a little worried about the long-term prospects. The estimates at this point are sort of fluid, but there are some analysts who think the ultimate legal bill here could be as high as $38 billion. Mm. Frankly, no one knows how much it's going to cost until we start to see how the early cases play out in court. It's really guesswork, but there is no doubt this is going to be very costly, and it's already hurt Merck tremendously in terms of their stock price.
Well, the stocks did plummet, but in addition, there are lawsuits, including one filed by the Maine Pension Fund of New York State. It charges that the company misled shareholders, and they could lose nearly, this is New York, could lose nearly $120 million in pension funds.
Right. The shareholder suits have been filed, and the SEC has actually begun an inquiry into the handling of the Vioxx withdrawal. It sounds as if the questions there surround whether Merck gave investors adequate warning or information about the potential problems with Vioxx.
What does Merck say in response to that charge?
Their argument is that they gave all the information that they had to the FDA, that they, as soon as this study came out, this most recent study that showed a problem with the drug, that they pulled the drug.
But what about the charges that there were the earlier studies in 1999 that pointed to some problems as well, and they didn't release those?
Yeah, that's where they get into some difficulty. Merck's whole argument is, yes, there were warning signs, but they can explain away a lot of the earlier data. It wasn't until this most recent study that they had, you know, cut and dried information and that they then pulled the drug.
Well, you mentioned not just the state suit, but individual lawsuits. Many newspapers are featuring ads by legal firms asking people who feel they've been negatively affected by Vioxx to come forward. Is this a growing industry?
Well, Yeah, this is big business for the trial lawyers. There's something like 20 million Americans who took this drug. And so you were talking about a large potential pool of people who may have been injured. We have not seen in the pharmaceutical industry, I don't think, anything on this scale before. The diet drugs, Pondamin and Redux, which were withdrawn back in 97, you know, everybody calls Fen-Phen, millions of people took those, but it was not nearly 20 million. And the tab for that is now over $16 billion, and that's likely to go a little higher still.
Will the consumer end up paying in the long run? Will Merck pass off some of these costs to the consumers?
I don't think so, because in many of the categories that they're competing in, there are other drugs, and it's going to be, I think, harder for them to pass along price increases in some of those categories. Plus, the big problem for the whole industry will be in 2006 when the government starts paying through a Medicare drug benefit. And most analysts are expecting that is going to put big pressure on industry pricing.
Amy Barrett covers the drug industry for Businessweek magazine. Amy, thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll have more on drugs and baseball. That's ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Judea Pearl was born in Israel, became an esteemed computer scientist at UCLA, and with his wife, Ruth, quietly raised a family. Then in February 2002, Judea's son, Daniel Pearl, was murdered, beheaded by terrorists in Pakistan. Incredibly, Judea and his wife decided the best revenge would be to create the Daniel Pearl Foundation to foster dialogue between Muslims and Jews. And more recently, they've edited a book echoing Danny's last words, which were recorded on tape. The book is called I Am Jewish, Personal Reflections Inspired by the Last Words of Daniel Pearl. And Judea joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Did you bring yourself to listen to those last words of your son?
Yes. I saw the good part of the video, and I've listened to those words. My father is Jewish, my mother is Jewish, and I'm Jewish.
What did you hear in that?
I hear just his normal character, which is, I'm sticking to the principle, I'm sticking to the facts, and these are the facts, and if you have any problem with it, it is your problem. But I have the right to be what I am, and I'm going to insist on those rights, and you come to your senses.
Because there are people who, when in talking about this, people have said to me, well, he was forced to say that.
That is not true, and we have evidence to that by the second sentence. The second sentence that comes after that is, back in the town of Bnei Brak, there is a street named after my great-grandfather, Chaim Peron, who was one of the founders of the town. Now, this fact is not known to anyone in the world except our family.
Mm. Okay. Interesting, because as you and others have said, Daniel, your son, was largely secular. Your family was secular.
Correct. We did practice a few of the holidays and the rituals. We made a kiddush every Friday night. Mm. We took it as an affirmation of tradition rather than committing a commandment.
But still, do you think that something happened for Daniel in those final moments?
It might possibly happen that in such a crisis, a person clings to a safety blanket. And for him, history and the place of his extended family in that strand of history was a safety blanket.
And what has that done for you?
Well, I'm a scientist, so it made me think, why is it that people cling to history in order to gain strength and endurance? And it makes sense, because history is what provides us with a picture, a global picture of where we are in relative to the universe. Otherwise, we are just a collection of particles wandering around in the plasma of other particles, and that's not too reassuring. Mm.
Did anyone you approached not want to talk about being a Jew?
Yes.
What were those reasons?
I don't think I am at liberty to divulge their names. I don't think it will be fair to them.
Well, you know, but I'm reminded of when Daniel was being held hostage in the early days, how you and your family were pleading with the press, please don't report that he is Jewish.
Correct.
I mean, there's fear.
But there's no fear of being Jewish. It's more fear of compromising one's position. For instance, some people from the media thought that their strength lies in neutrality. And the moment they affiliate themselves with a tribe of Jews, they would lose their power of neutrality in terms of their professional discourse. Others felt, for instance, that their ethnicity is a divisive force in our society, and they did not want to reinforce that divisiveness.
But those who did participate range from NPR's Daniel Shore to Norman Lear, author Cynthia Ozick, journalist Tom Friedman. I'm imagining that when he's reporting from certain parts of the Middle East, it is a huge part of his identity. What did he write about what being Jewish means to him?
Well, he talked about the danger of Jewish journalists as they travel through the Middle East. And he made a point that if they reveal the truth whenever they asked, they are respected. So it is both a danger and a tool.
Some of the anecdotes were funny. Larry King tells the joke about the Jewish grandmother who thanks God for saving her grandson from drowning, but adds, he had a hat. I love that story.
Yes.
Your favorite?
Well, if you open the page to what Sava Silverman said, she's also a comedian, and she gave a one-liner. Remember the guy who smashed the idols in the idol shop? That's me. I'm a Jew.
And Judea Pearl, that's sort of your definition of being a Jew as well. You're nodding yes.
Well, that's an attitude we have acquired. That we are the questioners of conventional wisdoms. And we got to be that way, not because we are smarter, but because of the travesties of history. Conventional wisdoms were mighty unkind to us. So we learned to, our sanity demanded that we will question them.
Why do you think there's so much anti-Semitism?
It's part of the same theme, that with our very existence, we constituted a proof of an alternative to the conventional wisdom. And no one appreciates alternatives. People are very comfortable in their belief, said belief. And here, when one presents to them an alternative, it's very disturbing in all walks of life, not only religion.
That sounds like the embodiment of your son. Even if not Jewish, he was an alternative. He was a truth.
Correct.
That people didn't want to hear.
Yes.
It's been 2.5 years.
Yes, almost 3.
Yes. How are you handling what was such a horrific public loss?
We are not driven now by the loss. We are driven by the opportunity. Because he and his image now became a symbol for East-West reconciliation, East-West dialogue.
People say, how could you think of having dialogue with people who not only murdered your son, but did it in such a horrific
way? I'm not concerned about the people who murdered. I'm concerned about their children. And here we have an opportunity of swaying their children to the side of opportunity.
How is Daniel Pearl's child, your
grandchild?
He's
immense. He's great. He has the same posture as his father. He's sure that all his environment was made for him and that he can walk through fire. As long as he sticks with his truth and principles, he's going to get his way.
But if he grows up and says, Grandpa, I'm not sure. I mean, my father was killed for being a Jew. I'm not sure I want to be one. I'm not sure. What will you tell him?
It's hard to tell. I don't know. It will be very hard for us to explain. But projects such as the dialogue we are doing and what will emerge from it, I think, will soften the blow.
Judea Pearl, the book he and his wife edited is called I Am Jewish, Personal Reflections Inspired by the Last Words of Daniel Pearl. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Michigan Congressman John Conyers is holding an informal hearing today on Capitol Hill to discuss voting irregularities in Ohio. Also today, a third challenge to the now official vote tally in Ohio is being launched. The group Alliance for Democracy is asking the Ohio Supreme Court to declare John Kerry the winner in the Buckeye State. Well, joining us now is Bev Harris. She's executive director of blackboxvoting.org. It's a voting watchdog group funded by citizen donations. She's in her car outside Orlando, Florida. And Bev, you're either going to Disneyland or you are tracking down another charge of irregularities?
Well, we've been tracking all over the state. Orlando's kind of in the middle of the state. It's a good jumping-off ground. We've actually literally been driving lickety-split from county to county, picking up records requests.
Well, as you well know, on Monday, the Ohio Secretary of State certified that President Bush won in Ohio by 118,775 votes. Are you going to be challenging that finding?
We aren't going to be challenging it in court, but we do have investigators in Ohio developing information. There are so many irregularities in Ohio that it definitely needs to be challenged in court.
Well, let's recap some of those challenges filed in Ohio this week. The Democratic National Committee is appointing its own panel to review voting problems in Ohio. Lawyers for the Green and Libertarian parties, backed by John Kerry, have formally requested a full recount. And as we said today, the Alliance for Democracy is filing its lawsuit on behalf of 25 Ohio voters who claim widespread voting irregularities and fraud in heavily Republican counties in the Cincinnati area. Now, Ohio election officials say their system is among the fairest in the nation because every county board has two Democrats and two Republicans. And, Bev, we've talked to other reporters who've also said that, you know, they've tried to get to the bottom of charges of fraud as opposed to just messed up stuff. And they said, you know, it's virtually impossible because in most cases the Democrats would have to have been as involved.
Oh, that's not true. And in fact, our experience is that most of the people who are supposedly in a watchdog position inside the counties really don't understand the voting systems. They rely on a vendor or a manufacturer to tell them how it works.
Yeah. Well, Congressman Conyers and three other Democratic members of Congress are asking the Ohio Secretary of State to investigate a number of irregularities, among them the reporter lockout in the Warren County building where voting was held. Officials there said it was a terror threat. You know, as we've said on this program, the appearance of more votes than voters in some areas, and perhaps most significantly, an estimated 93,000 ballots that were spoiled on Ohio punch card machines where no vote was recorded in the presidential race. Your thoughts on these allegations?
Right, and there are more irregularities, too. It gets very interesting. The voter registration program in the Cuyahoga County, which is Cleveland, had very significant anomalies that affected perhaps as many as 100,000 voters. The purging of voters that was done on that made no sense whatsoever, and the dates of update in that were very suspicious. For example, there were tens of thousands of records in that supposedly were updated in the 1800s on the computer.
Bev Harris, again, blackboxvoting.org. Do you see this past election being overturned?
I think it's possible. The problem with overturning an election is that you're constantly playing beat the clock. The odds are against you is if they stall on certain production of documents. So it's going to be interesting. I do think it's possible all the way up for maybe as much as a year from now.
Well, you know, some people would say, boy, that's, you know, most of the country has moved on.
Oh, I don't think so. We're meeting some very relentless citizens. But it's very difficult because the county election officials do not run transparent elections in so many locations now where you can't even get the records. We just videotaped a pile of shredded absentee ballots that were filled out, that were recovered from the trash in one Florida county. And that's a story we're going to be breaking later this week.
Bev Harris, executive director of BlackBoxVoting.org, a consumer protection nonprofit funded by citizens' donations. She joined us from somewhere outside of Orlando, Florida, on her cell phone. Bev, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And for more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Headline writers are having a field day with baseball today. Here's one. Baseball's bulging crisis. Here's another. No flex in union muscle. But Major League Baseball players have now agreed to negotiate with owners on tougher testing for steroids. This comes after reports that New York Yankees slugger Jason Giambi admitted to injecting himself with a human growth hormone and taking steroids for 3 seasons. Penalties for steroid use in baseball started in 2003, but testing didn't begin until this past season. Joining us on the line, Peter Robey, director of the Center for the Study of Sport in Society at Northeastern University. Hi, Peter.
Hi. How are you, Robin?
Good. We're also joined by Dave Kindred, columnist for the Sporting News. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you, Robin.
And Dave, I want to start with you because we see that headline, no flex in union muscle, and then we hear today that the players have agreed to negotiate about drug testing. So what's happening?
Well, I think they've agreed to talk, which is a step because in years previous, they've not even agreed to talk about this issue. So it's a small step. There's a long way to go before the players agree to a really stringent testing program that I think is needed.
Well, Peter Robey, by the way, your headline today was the baseball's bulging crisis. For those who aren't really following this story closely, give us some reference points. I mean, how does this compare to other sports? Some people might be saying, you're kidding, they get to decide whether they're tested?
Well, in terms of comparison, there are testing policies that have a lot more teeth and rigor to them in other major sports compared to baseball. I mean, baseball up until just a year or so ago hadn't really had any kind of language in their bargaining agreement that would deter players at all from being involved with illegal drugs or performance-enhancing drugs. And even what they've now put into their collective bargaining agreement is not a deterrent in any way to someone wanting to cheat.
Again, explain that. How does that work?
Well, it's all about bargaining. You know, I mean, you have two sides that have interests that are divergent, and they're going to figure out how they can get what they need most. And the owners were coming off a work stoppage in 95 that put such a black mark on the game of baseball that, you know, sometimes you have to concede in certain issues in order to get back to playing the game. And they obviously didn't feel like that was an issue that they wanted to fight, especially since if, in fact, guys are using steroids and they end up hitting home runs on a record pace, it's going to put more people in the seats. So at the end of the day, they may have thought, well, this ends up benefiting us anyway.
And Dave Kindred, let's remind people there was a baseball strike and there weren't people in seats anywhere. And then, you know, the sport was flagging and it was those home run battles that brought them back to the parks.
Well, certainly it made everyone feel good, I think, that one year with Sosa and Mark McGwire. But I'm not persuaded that home runs alone make people come to the ballpark. I think people came to baseball parks for a long, long time in great numbers. Before steroids, they'll come in great numbers after steroids. I just want it cleaned up. I want everybody playing the same game.
Well, you do, but some speculate, you know, they don't really care. I mean, if an athlete's going to, you know, have a great home run race and make them feel good, that's more of a pull.
Well, yeah, I don't believe that. I can't believe that people want to see cheaters perform. I think that people want to see a game played fairly under rules that everyone understands and agrees to. And I don't think anyone is going to agree to rules that let people cheat.
Peter Robey, do you think the use of steroids in Major League Ball is also causing another problem? You know, is filtering down
no
to some of those fans?
no question. I mean, it sends such a bad message to all the young athletes out there who are striving to be as good as they can be that might have held these athletes up as role models. And now that they see that some of the folks that they respected the most for their abilities have had to cheat to achieve a certain level, it's making them think whether the risk and the reward, if the risk outweighs the reward or not. Our biggest concern beyond the integrity of the game is the message that it sends to all the young athletes out there about integrity, honesty, and competing fairly.
So what should happen now? I mean, you write, few would disagree that players like Bonds, Barry Bonds, and Giambi have been using steroids for years and that Major League Baseball and the Players Union have known about it. So, for instance, should there be some impact on the record books and the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Well, I think it's going to be difficult for them to rescind what's already happened, especially since they didn't have any rules against that particularly, or they weren't able to find it out. So, you know, it'll be very hard for them, I think, to take some of those records off the books.
What about the future?
Well, you know, the future is if there's a rigorous drug testing policy, then it should be like any other sport where if there's a just cause for thinking that folks are abusing it, or if they have random testing and people flunk it, then they pay the consequence.
But it gets complicated, and Dave Kindred, I want to bring you in here. It gets complicated. Someone like Barry Bonds might have had a record that occurred before he started taking steroids, and it's not illegal.
Well, certainly Bonds in the first 15 years of his career was a Hall of Fame player without steroids, won 3 MVPs, hit maybe 30 home runs a year for 15 years. The last 5 years, he's been a different man, a different body, and a different player. Yeah, and he's won 4 MVPs now for a total of 7. I think you leave the records where they are. I think you let readers, you let the intelligent fans decide what those records mean. There's no note beside Babe Ruth's 60 home runs in 1927 that he was hitting a different baseball than players hit in 1919. But we know it. We allow for that. And I think history is served best by leaving the records where they are and just let people make up their own opinions of what those records mean.
Well, I know you're a member of the Baseball Writers Association, Dave. Would you vote for Bonds?
No.
Because?
If he were on the Hall of Fame ballot tomorrow, I would not vote for him. It's just my personal opinion that he has stained the game as badly as Pete Rose stained the game. It's a different kind of violation, but it bothers me just almost as much as Rose's.
Peter Roby, player Jose Canseco, has a book coming out, and he said that up to 85% of major league ball players use steroids. Do you think it's that prevalent? And if so, I mean, next season, are we going to see a bunch of, you know, much thinner players on the field?
Well, I think you're definitely going to see the physiques of a number of players changed from what they looked like the last few years. That certainly was the situation with Giambi when he came to training camp with the Yankees this past season. The writers and the players all looked at him and said, "What the heck happened to you?" Because after the allegations had gotten out there, he obviously got off the cycle of steroid use, and his body totally changed. So I think you're definitely going to see a physical change in players. I think the issue is, regardless of how many players have been using performance-enhancing drugs, baseball, the players' union, and anyone connected to the game have to come together and put a policy together that will deter people from using steroids to protect their own long-term health as well as the integrity of the game of baseball.
Do you worry if baseball doesn't do it, Congress will?
There's no question about that now. You know, Congress will definitely act with regard to the antitrust exemption. They've threatened to use that many times before when they couldn't get baseball to kind of make the kind of decisions that they thought were in the best interest of the fans and the game. But I think with the public outcry that we've now seen and the media scrutiny around this and the fact that the revelations have been proven to be true, there's no question that Congress will act this time. And I think the players and the owners know that, and I think that's why you're starting to see movement already.
Peter Roby, director of the Center for the Study of Sport and Society at Northeastern University, and Dave Kindred, columnist for the Sporting News. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Karen Miller-Medson, Kevin Sullivan, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Mike Toda. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer, Lindsay Crudell. Our interns are Danielle Dreilinger and Jennifer Miller. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.